Hey, everybody, quick reminder, the Other People podcast is a listener-supported show. All episodes are free, nearly 500 episodes and counting, all available free of charge. There is an official Other People app. That, too, is free. Everything's free. So if you listen regularly and you would like to support this program, you can do so at patreon.com/otherpplpod. Once again, that's patreon.com/otherpplpod. All support is greatly appreciated. Okay, let's get started.
You are not alone. You have found other people.
You and I have a friend in common.
Every stupid thing that a writer could do, I've done.
I think it's really beautiful.
Dig, what a struggle, you know?
It was incredible. You know, it was like your head exploded seeing what was really there.
And now here's your host, Brad Listy.
Just one person at just one time.
Hey, everybody. How's it going? Right. Welcome to the Other People podcast. I'm Brad Listy. I'm in Los Angeles. It's great to be with you, and I have an excellent show for you today. I'm very excited to have Jarrett Middleton here. He is the author of a novel called Darkensaw. It's called Darkensaw. It's available now from DeZank Books. It is the official November pick of the Nervous Breakdown Book Club. And Jarrett and I had an incredibly rich conversation. We recorded a while ago. He was swinging through town on a book tour. He was traveling the country and reading for people, and he stopped by and sat down. And it was just one of those conversations that got me excited when I thought about being able to share it with you. So that is coming up in just a moment. Jarrett Middleton, his novel, one more time, is called Darkensaw. And, you know, before we get going, I do feel like it's very important to talk about the Matthew Salicis fundraiser that I'm doing. If you're new to the program or are not aware of what is going on, I am doing a T-shirt fundraiser for Matthew Salicis and family. Matt was a guest on this program in, I believe, episode 145. He is an author of several books and a mensch, a very beloved member of the literary community. His wife, Catherine, is battling stomach cancer. It's a very difficult situation. She is in Korea with her family and one of their children as she undergoes treatment. Matt, meanwhile, is holding down the fort here in the States, working a job. He's with their eldest child. So not only are they dealing with a very serious illness in their family, but they're also geographically separated in the name of proper medical care and family support. And so they're raising funds to help bridge the gap for some aggressive treatments and also to fund travel expenses and so on and so forth. They have a burden on them financially and otherwise. And we, you know, there is a fundraiser that has been happening independent of this program, trying to raise funds to help them. And they're getting close. They're about $20,000 shy of their goal. In order to be fully funded, they need $90,000. They're at 70 now. So I'm trying to sell T-shirts to help bridge that gap. And there has been a very exciting development since I spoke about this last week. Many of you may be aware. Roxane Gay, also an author, also a past guest on this program. Many of you, pretty much everybody probably knows who Roxane Gay is at this point. She has very, very generously agreed to match funds up to $5,000. So if we raise $5,000, she'll put down another $5,000. That gets us to $10,000. So very exciting. I think we're going to get there. We have, at the time that this show airs, there are 2 days left to support this fundraiser. If we hit $10,000, if we max that or whatever, great. We can push past it. Let's keep going. So if by the time you listen to this, we've already hit that 5K, meaning with Roxane's matching funds, we're at 10K. Great. Add on top of it, because we need to get the Salicis family, we need to get them to 20K. That's the goal. In an effort to get there, I have put out a call to publishers, because I feel like this is a member of the literary community whom we are trying to support. I'm asking people who work at publishing companies who might listen to this program to consider matching the 10K that we raise. Can you do that? Can you support this author and donate $10,000, match it, get this family fully funded, ease their burden, do a very good thing? In exchange for that, what I'm offering, if you match 10K, if you're a publisher or some other company or some person of extraordinary means, I will offer you 20 episodes of sponsorship on this podcast. So if you're a publisher, 20 episodes, I will sing your praises. I will personally voice ads, for books that you want to, get the word out about and so on and so forth. If you're interested, you can DM me on Twitter. My handle on Twitter is @otherppl. That's the podcast Twitter feed. You can also email me at letters@otherppl.com. That's letters@otherppl.com. If you are listening to this program and you have not yet got a t-shirt and supported this thing, I hope you'll consider doing that now. It's an easy way to do something very good in this world. And certainly the world could use some more good stuff happening. There's a lot of dark stuff happening. So here's a way to do something and to shine a little light. And I know that many of you out there who listen have already done so, and I just want to say thank you for doing that. It means a lot to me. I know it means a lot to Matt Salasis and his family. It's not easy to need help. It's not easy to ask for help. And, you know, the truth is, I don't know Matt and Catherine. I've never met Catherine. I've talked to Matt on this program. We did it by Skype. So I've never actually even been in his presence. But I remember very well the conversation that we had and how we were talking about being fathers. We were both, you know, young fathers, basically, or new to fatherhood. And I remember we bonded about that in our call. It made an impression on me. And just his overall goodness made an impression on me. And to think of going through something like this as a husband, as a father, as a human being, period. It really tugs at the heart. It's not an easy thing to have to deal with, to say the least. And it bums me out that we live in a country and in a world where we have to crowdsource funds for cancer treatment, where we have to do t-shirt fundraisers to help people pay for medical bills when they're seriously ill. That bums me out. But you know what? That's how things are right now. So you have to kind of play the hand you're dealt. And I don't know. I don't know why. This whole set of circumstances has moved me to act. I felt like, well, you know what? I have this show. I have this microphone. I have this audience. Let's see if we can put it to good use and get this thing figured out. This small thing, this matter of dollars. Let's see if we can make it right. This one thing in the world. Let's make it right. So that's what we're doing here. If you want to support the cause, there is a link at otherppl.com. You can find it on the show's website. You can go to the Twitter feed at otherppl. You can check us out, the other people Facebook feed. It's all there. I've been talking about it incessantly on social media and posting it on otherppl.com. It's also posted on thenervousbreakdown.com. Track it down. Click on the link. Get a t-shirt. Get multiple t-shirts. Make a donation. Support the cause. Do a good thing. Make this right. My guest again is Jarrett Middleton. His novel is called Darkensaw. It is the official November selection of the Nervous Breakdown Book Club. I am not exaggerating when I say we had a wonderful conversation. It was really, really interesting. And it ran a little long. I didn't care. I could have sat there all night practically. So very pleased to get to share this with you. Very pleased to get to shine a light on this excellent novel, Darkensaw. Here he is, ladies and gentlemen. This is the author, Jarrett Middleton.
Yeah, I was joking around with folks at the reading last night. New Hampshire's, you know, much like a lot of places in this country. I mean, even to, you know, Darkensaw and the book is set in the Ozarks, right?
Yeah, what are you doing in the Ozarks?
And I'm just, you know, well, the story about the Bain twins and the cyclical murder myth and the curse in the book, I mean, it just had to happen. It had to be told in a family of bluegrass musicians in the hills and the Ozarks. But I'm really attracted to these sort of like liminal, geographical settings where, you know, it's almost like, yeah, there is modern civilization, but you take a wrong turn or you keep going down the end of the lane and you're in the, you're going backwards in time, you know?
Yeah, it's not very many turns.
Exactly. The Ozarks are like that, and then New Hampshire's like that. I'm from the seacoast. I'm from a beach town, so I grew up playing drums in a punk rock band and surfing and skateboarding and snowboarding in the White Mountains in the winter.
Sure.
It's a great place to grow up.
You surf in New Hampshire?
Yeah.
Really?
Freezing.
Yeah.
Freezing cold.
I would bet.
But consequently, I love the cold. I'm a, you know, good old New Englander like that. But, the seacoast is very cultured and progressive, and it's a great quality of life. But then at the same time, some of my friends back home, they got their sleeves cut off and they, you know, the videos they post on social media is them unloading, you know, fully automatic machine guns, and
sure,
they smoke two packs a day. And
what is it? What is the state motto of New Hampshire?
Live free or die.
Live free or die. That's
right. FOD 603.
I was going to say, don't tread on me. But it's,
those are the tattoos. The LFOD 603 with the granite state with the old man on the mountain, the White Mountains.
There is like a rugged individualism, and it just don't fuck with me.
It's like a don't tread on me, but in the north.
Yeah,
I read one some. Saying a long time ago that New Hampshire is the south of the north.
Yeah, I mean, I always joke because I grew up partially in Indiana, and I always joke that it's the Utah of the Midwest, which is sort of a similar kind of vibe, you know?
Yeah.
Where it's like it's out of, you know, I always say it's like just its latitude is not necessarily in line with like its attitude. How do you like that for a rhyme? It's pretty good.
You know, trademark that.
Yeah, I should. Well, I think Jimmy Buffett beat me to it. But yeah, like there are these, and I read an excellent essay about it actually, and it was something that I wish I could paraphrase well, but it basically broke down the way that like migratory patterns worked in early colonial America, combined with like socioeconomics, and like it basically explained why that is. There's a reason for it, or like a set of reasons for it. And, you know, America doesn't necessarily sort itself out perfectly according to geography, latitude, et cetera. Like a lot
of and so much in New England is it was the first colonies and it was the first cities and it was the first states, right? So yeah. Those communities, they weren't planned. I mean, you look at it like a road map of Boston and it's like, you know, John Hancock had to build a road from his house to the post office.
Right.
And that's why that road is there.
Practical. Very practical.
You know, and then, you know, you see New York and it's like, you see Boston, let's not do what they did.
Yeah, let's make a grid.
Let's make a grid. Exactly. A little planning goes a long way. No, I read a same idea. I read a great essay. I think it might have been Boston Magazine or the Boston Review. That had a phenomenal essay, same concept, about, you know, in New England, the colonial patterns of settlement. And they said that culture in Boston was split between North Shore and South Shore. And the split could go all the way back to the Pilgrims Landing at Plymouth Rock on the south end and the Puritans in Salem and the witch burnings.
The Pilgrims were the hipsters, dude.
They were.
They had culture.
They were cool.
Yeah. That's crazy.
And then the Puritans were not so cool.
That's interesting. So the split
was there. And you can see it today.
The split was there from the beginning.
Yeah. And it's still, I mean, I read it and I grew up in it and I had never phrased the cultural divide in that way.
That's like the origin story.
It is. And then it's one of those things that just snapped into place and it was an aha moment. I went, that is so correct.
So, okay. So are you, like Middleton? What is that? Is it English? What is that?
The Middleton is my father's, side, and my father's Canadian.
Oh,
Toronto, Scarborough.
Okay.
He was a professional hockey player. He was the captain of the Boston Bruins.
No shit.
He was.
Wow.
So Boston heritage, my dad was the captain of the Boston Bruins and he's the president of the Bruins alumni today. So he's still involved with the team.
Wow.
I grew up playing hockey every day of my life until I was 14.
That's a good sport.
Yeah. It's the best.
That's good.
I'm built for it too.
Yeah. You gotta be, cause these guys, when you see these hockey players, they're like world-class athletes, but like these guys aren't like shredded. It's like a different kind of body type and
yeah, they're just the most rugged, pliable. I mean, it's the hardest. The athleticism is so well-rounded. Yeah, right. They're not shredded. They're not cut. You know, they're not so finely tuned.
But to skate on, like to skate, change directions, be it like a dead sprint on the ice, like all that stuff, like that's exhausting.
Oh, I mean, I was on an elite squad when I was coming up. And I was on the pre-pro track until I was 14.
And then what happened? You started playing in a punk band?
Yeah, I mean, long story short, parents got divorced. My mother got sick. She's well and good now.
Oh, she is?
Oh, yeah.
Good.
Absolutely.
What did she get? What was her sickness?
She had cancer, and she was a horrific alcoholic.
Okay.
So my family just sort of imploded.
All right.
So, I mean, the structured life of hockey, right? And the pressure on me with my dad's name and coming up playing in New England.
No
right?
pressure. He's only the captain of the Bruins.
No pressure. There were, well, literally, I was sitting down at 12, 13 with trainers, scouts. I did summer training. I did off-ice training. Damn. They used to put me in a harness, make me skate on a plexiglass treadmill.
Uh-huh.
They used to take my oxygen intake.
It's like Ivan Drago in Rocky IV.
Exactly. No, so, you know, I had a five-day-a-week hockey schedule when I was 13. And I was good. It was all I ever knew, but I didn't necessarily love it. I was an introvert. I was an artist. I loved music and politics and you know, writing. So my family got divorced. And even just the move from the North Shore of Boston to the seacoast of New Hampshire. You know, it's so funny, we're out here in the West and everything's so massively spread out.
Yeah.
That move is about less than 45 minutes north along the coast.
Right.
And it was like a different country.
It's like you went to Mars.
It was like I went to Mars. It was like, oh, well, the hockey culture of North Boston isn't bearing down. People aren't asking me where I'm going to play Division I school.
Right.
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 Or full hockey scholarships.
That's hard to be like the son of the captain of the Boston Bruins. And to, you know, like, even if you're not an introvert.
Right.
That's a lot to carry.
Well, I grew up with Ray Bourque's son, Chris Bourque.
Uh-huh.
He played in the NHL for a few years.
And this is before, like, the hockey salaries were, like, through the roof. Like,
right? Yeah, my dad's career is very interesting.
You can get closer to the mic, too, just to make sure we get you.
Yeah, he was, you know, in that era where he told me stories where role players and tough guys, you know, on the third and fourth lines, they would work construction in the summer.
Yeah.
You know,
that's like old pro, that's like old pro football players.
Yeah.
These guys just got wrecked.
Exactly. They did.
They didn't
and when they were
rich.
Used up, they just tossed them.
That's right. And these, I mean, like even today, the average career in football, I mean, you read about it. It's like 2.5 or 3 years for people who make it.
Yeah, it's brutal.
They don't get any money. They got no guaranteed salaries. I mean, but the only way that I can even make sense of doing something, and hockey, I don't think falls quite into this category, though. I guess there's some danger to traumatic head injury and stuff like that.
There is actually it's funny that it just sort of came up from talking, but the novel I'm halfway into right now is about a young hockey player from New England drawing on my roots for the first time really in my work, and gets a vicious head hit and has to deal with CTE, chronic traumatic encephalopathy,
right,
which is a degenerative brain disorder.
Yeah, yeah. That,
you know, between the NFL and the NHL.
What's the incidence of hockey players who get this?
Oh, it's extremely high.
Oh, it is.
It is.
Shit. I was thinking, because I feel like hockey, you get bashed a lot into the boards, but like it's not doesn't seem quite as vicious.
Well, a lot of it is a lot of it was fighting.
Right.
You know, my dad didn't wear a helmet.
Uh-huh.
You know, all his teeth are fake.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
These guys are tough.
You see him walking around with his shirt off, and, you know, he looks like someone stitched him back together.
Uh-huh.
But he wasn't even a fighter. He was a nifty little goal scorer. His nickname was Nifty.
But
back in the 70s, he had the big guys. He had Terry O'Reilly and Derek Sanderson.
These goons.
And they were just the toughest guys you've ever seen. If anybody touched my dad, these guys would come over and pound the hell out of them. But no, the prevalence of CTE and concussion symptoms in hockey, the data, the arc for the data is over a lifetime. It's over years.
Yeah.
It really came about with a fighter named Bob Probert from the Detroit Red Wings. He died rather abruptly when he was 52, 53, and he had told his wife that he knew something was wrong with his brain, and nobody believed him.
That's like Dave Duerson, the football player. He like left a note, was like, you know, save my brain, basically.
So Bob Probert donated his brain to science, and they opened it and found these regressive plaque structures in the central cortex of his brain. And it was the first time they could confirm CTE as a degenerative disorder, but it was only with a brain, a very, you know, damaged brain from repeated trauma for years, only after death. But now they're developing tests to test for it while you're alive.
God, well, they just did this.
So I'm reading a lot about it for the new book.
Yeah,
and my character. Yeah,
I mean,
it's fascinating.
They just did the football study, and I want to say 99% of it, like literally 99% of the players they tested So that means if you're playing professional, if you're playing professional football, like you're getting this shit. Like your brain is going to be.
Well, and there's no real data because so much money and effort has gone into the suppression of it.
Yeah.
I mean, that would 90, like you said, the recent study this year for the NFL, 99%, 98%, 99%. That could be a death knell for the NFL.
Okay. So
if it was treated seriously.
Okay. So this is making me think that like, it's actually a blessing that you're an introvert and you did not go on to a professional hockey career.
Yep. I just dealt with the hazards of being an introvert.
I was an introvert and a writer, which comes with its own like traumatic brain issues.
Different traumatic brain issues.
So, okay. So you're a kid, you're growing up, you're a sort of expected, I think, at least if not by your folks, by your community to be like a hockey star. I think that's sort of expected of the sons.
First part of my life, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So you're growing up, and you're in a household where your mother is battling alcoholism, and then at 14, things come to a head. And like at this point, are you already, reading books? Are you literary at that point? Or is this something that happened after your mom gets sick and after she, I'm assuming she sobered up?
She did. She is, she's over a decade sober now.
Right.
And we're close, you know. I love my mother dearly. So the other half of the Boston story is, while my dad's Canadian and, you know, played for the Bruins,
right,
which made him a big star in Boston, my mother is South Boston Irish Catholic.
Okay.
She calls me Jay. She's got a wicked accent.
Uh-huh.
Huge family. Goes way back in Jamaica Plain and down the South Shore to Hull.
Just like dozens of kids.
Oh, I mean, when I go home, it's I got seven aunts and uncles.
And my mom
40, 50,
yeah,
you know, nieces, cousins, nephews, cousins.
Well, yep. So like it went generational.
Absolutely.
Like the next generation had like 10 kids too.
I mean, every time I go home, because I'm on the West Coast, every time I go home, I feel bad to say it, but I lose track of who I'm meeting. I'm like, wait, how do you, it's like a flow chart.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a lot to keep track of.
I mean, no, and a lot of them, they still go to the same Catholic church. They never left, you know, their hometown. They all, you know, they get the Christmas card with the Irish knit wool sweaters. And
I envy that a little bit.
I do, you know, in a weird way, too, I do too.
Having that like full extended family nearby, having that sense of.
And I love all of them deeply. I mean, I just think there is something to be said for the tight knit structured.
And if they're able
to make it through. There are a lot of them that are, you know, my cousins that are in college, the young professionals, they're very successful. They're very, you know, they're wonderful people. You know, my life just went a different way.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, that's the thing. You know, I wish that my sisters were out here or that I was, like, that we were all in the same place. But, you really can't predict. I never expected to live in Los Angeles until suddenly I did. It wasn't something I planned out. You know, like life just ticks.
So what's the short version of that since, you know?
Graduate school? What do you mean? Like, what's the short version of how I got here?
How you landed in LA?
I went to graduate school here. I sort of didn't know what I was doing, but I was like, oh, I got into USC, so I'll go there and try to write a book. And then I did that. And then I hung around and then I met my wife. And then, you know, like, and next thing you know, you look up and it's been almost 20 years.
Yeah. If anybody asked me, you know, if I could see myself almost a decade in Seattle, you know, there was no... There was nothing of providence leading me there. It was just, you know, it's where we built a life.
There you go. So we'll get to Seattle, but I want to get back into your teenage years because I feel like 14, 15, 16, 17, those had to be kind of pivotal years for you. You were going through a lot. Your parents split up. That's right when you turn into music. That's right when a thing like art starts to like mean a lot.
So you asked, was I literary?
Yeah.
Yeah. I had the blessing to grow up in the Boston punk rock scene.
Okay.
So.
And that was vibrant?
It was huge.
Okay.
And I didn't know how blessed I was until you travel, you meet people like Midwest, you know, small towns. They go like, we didn't have that.
Yeah, I didn't have that.
We went to shows three nights a week. We were in bands. We could barely play four chords. And we played basement shows or the VFW hall and there's 500 kids there.
Wow.
So I was really blessed because, you know, you grow in punk rock, you grow up with the lore of 77 and, you know, in, you know, hardcore early 80s, then it kind of dies out. But looking back on it now, especially in 2017, the 90s was a big second wave boom for punk. You know, punk was charting, you know, whether or not it was poppy, like, you know, Rancid, Green Day, Blink-182, like they were charting. And then that meant all those bands on all those labels were getting exposure and being played. Boston was just this hotbed where it was this even mix of punk rock, hardcore, and straight edge hardcore in the 90s.
Yeah.
And ska.
Right.
Right. So you would go to, a straight edge hardcore show on a Monday night and get your head kicked in.
Do you ever know that, you ever heard of the band, Split Lip?
Yeah.
That was a kid that went to my high school, started that band, or he was in it. That's like my only connection, but like I wasn't in that scene, but like, and he was pretty much in my high school, he was like the entire scene. But like, what was straight edge? Like you get your ass kicked. It was violent.
Straight edge is sort of funny to talk about now, but I mean, straight edge started, the orthodoxy of straight edge started with Ian McKay and Minor Threat in DC.
All right.
But I mean, it was the no drugs, no drinking, no sex. It was just this very,
no sex.
I think the sex thing was sort of
the soft edge. Everybody needs one vice.
However many X's you earn. But it was this sort of hyper-aggressive hardcore. Right. So, you know, it wasn't street punk, and it wasn't metal. It was right in the middle. It came out of that second wave. So the early bands that were sort of Boston legends, when I was 12, I got into punk really young. I went to my first show when I was 11, I think.
Wow.
You know, I remember my dad dropping me off at the Middle East in Cambridge in like 95, 96, you know, maybe because I was a hockey player and I could handle myself.
Did he teach you how to fight?
I mean, I think hockey taught me how to fight.
You fight as like an 11-year-old hockey player.
Yep.
You're punching. It's part of the culture.
Yep, definitely. And then you go to shows that when you're 12 years old and, you know, kids are doing windmill kicks and flying off the stage and running on heads, and you just, the shows were when it started out, I know I sound like an old man, like, you know, back in the day it was great, and then, you know, I got a younger brother who's also very into punk and hardcore, and he was 5-6 years younger than me, and he said when I got out of it and he got into it, he said just that gap, he goes, the shows are so violent now, I can't even go anymore.
People are just frustrated. And
it was nuts. It was nuts. I mean, when I got out by 17, 18, so it was really, I went to college in Montreal and I was writing and reading at that. And I was really politically active at that time too.
Wow.
So I think the political consciousness of punk rock, you know, gave way to, I actually got into reading basically by politics first.
Like Noam Chomsky?
Yeah, Chomsky's that gateway. You know, yeah. Bad Religion put out a 7-inch with their songs on one side and a Chomsky speech on the other side, the B side.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah, I've read some Chomsky. I mean, like, I can read, like, I'm very, I don't know, like, not malleable, persuadable, but like, you know, you read like Naomi Klein or you read Chomsky or you read, I don't know, any like well-written treatise, like you can kind of, it has an effect on you. I can, like, I come away from Chomsky and I'm like, this fucking world is fucked. Like,
yeah, it's very, it's very argumentative. It's bleak,
but it's also like this deadpan. He's such a collected, you know, he doesn't have any kind of like
he's
emotional.
So deadpan.
Yeah. And so he's like,
I met him once.
Oh, you did?
I did. I some of my stories out of context sound bizarre. I was a young student radical. And I was, you know, increasingly left. So from the, you know, I'm kind of jumping around, but I was a student radical when I was 16. And then I increasingly went left. So I eventually was influenced by anarchist thinkers. And then, but really the, you know, anarchism and Marxism leads to political philosophy. And then political philosophy leads to heavy real philosophy. And then philosophy even just sort of leads to the narrative thrust of philosophy as a form of prose.
Okay.
If that makes any sense. You know, it was kind of that in poetry. And I started to find how influential, how tight-knit the narrative thrust of philosophy was.
Hmm.
That was the big gear in my brain that actually deposited me somewhere in the realm of fiction.
Really?
It did.
I guess that makes sense. I mean, there are a lot of people that I've talked with on this show who I think have an educational background in philosophy, like that was their major in college, or
that was mine before I switched to writing.
Oh, really? Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Or like, you know, or their work is heavily influenced. Like they read a lot of philosophy just as like, you know, for pleasure and inspiration or whatever.
I still do.
You do?
Yeah.
Who are your philosophers?
influential or like who I always go to for, you know, always return to?
Who do you always return to?
I always return to, first and foremost, Deleuze.
Okay.
French postmodernist. I mean, so in one way, so batshit out there that it's the lexicon and the syntax, it's an entire new way to even connect thought epistemologically. You know, it's not even a one-dimensional, you know, point A to point B argumentative structure. He was thinking thoughts in a new way. I don't think anybody, even Deleuze scholars, could ever even write about it and say this is what Deleuze means.
Do you like it? Okay, so why do you like it so much? Is it one of these things where like he just sort of like rattles your cage and I don't know. I can see that having like a loosening effect to read somebody who is jumping around and thinking and writing really unconventionally. Like, is there something really lucid in there that you can find?
Yeah, for me personally, for Deleuze, he came out of the Western Marxist sort of the 60s revival of Marxism, right? So he came out of Paris 68, but in academic philosophy, postmodernism had already taken root. So Marxism is very modernist. It's early modernist, very structured, right? It's very systemic. And then Deleuze was actually a student of Foucault's in France in the 50s and 60s. So it had the Marxist, the social and class-based analysis of Marxism and the intellectual rigor of Marxism, but without any of the ideology. So then that was what led me in, and I could identify the thread. It's like I was just pulling the thread and I got led in further. And then I looked up and I went, oh, this isn't what he's doing at all. You know, the class-based analysis is one thread in a tapestry. There's 100 different analyses here. So he started talking about the state and power and the structure of the ego and how essentially he started saying, well, you know, let's stop talking about things in revolutionary terms. Let's stop talking about things in emancipatory terms. And let's start looking at, this is an old Marxism trick, but let's start looking at the internal contradictions of the thing in itself. So then when he did that, he didn't just do that for egregious displays of misuses of power. Right. Like, it's easy to criticize power when it's fascism or the Holocaust or police brutality. Right. But it's much harder to criticize power in and of itself, even in its most responsible uses. Right.
Right.
Then he just started doing that with everything. He just did that with language. He has a chapter in a book called 1,000 Plateaus, like a chapter that's called like, what does the earth think it is, about objective form being a form of in nature being a form of consciousness and self-creation. So, I mean, it's just myriad,
right?
A to Z. And then all of a sudden, if I'm feeling stuck in fiction or an essay or film or whatever I'm doing at any point, I feel like it forms new neural pathways.
That's what I was going to say.
I find a way around the obstacle.
Yeah. It's like a laxative.
I go around it. I go above it. I go under it.
Right.
It's like a laxative. It just kicks it out of your head.
Okay. Good to know.
So that works for me when I'm stuck.
Well, no, I mean, and like, and I think a lot of writers have that, but it's a good thing to remember is that you got to have those kind of like, they're almost like desk references, like books you keep near the desk in case you need them.
And definitely.
You know, you're having a slow day or you just need some inspiration, and some books, they give you that shot consistently over time. It's nice when you find one that like doesn't diminish or that you find new things in as you go.
That's why I said Deleuze.
Yeah.
I mean, I could talk about a dozen others, but Deleuze is the most, it never diminishes. It's you change and you come back to it, and the same content was there the entire time, and some of it you didn't have access to yet.
Uh-huh.
Or some of it you never connected point A to point B until you were ready to.
Right.
I mean, that's the most motivation. If I could even write, you know, with a thread of that amount of like plasticity and that amount of just utter sheer brilliance, you know, That's the goal.
So are you, okay, so where are you, you said you were a student radical politically. I'm not entirely sure what that means, but like punk rock, I can sort of begin to form an image.
Oh, well, yeah. You want like the highlights?
Yeah.
So in high school, I formed a student rights group that was banned from meeting on school grounds.
Why?
I don't really know.
Were you violent?
No, not at all.
It's like the Weather Underground of your high school.
I mean, I eventually got toward, you know, fairly confrontational, you know, violent anarchist groups. That was a little later, but no, starting out in high school, it was just, we opposed things like after Columbine, we opposed wearing ID badges.
Okay.
Just small little policy changes, right? But I think the school board and the you know, paltry politics of the local school boards and, you know, town councils and whatever weren't used to even being observed or hearing input from students. The ROTC had a firing range on our campus for our high school.
That's comforting.
So then we just went to the school board meetings and we went, well, if there's a zero tolerance policy on firearms for students, why is the ROTC allowed to discharge weapons on school grounds? And then all hell broke loose. All we did was ask critical questions.
Yeah.
You know, so it was banned. Yeah. No, this, all right. Here's a funny story. So we were banned from meeting. So then what we did the next year was twofold. One, we started a bunch of front groups that were accepted from the student union that came with a student budget. So we started like Amnesty International. We started, you know, all the, you know, whatever, vigil groups and social change groups and whatever. And then this is right after 9/11. So we threw a benefit concert for Iraq, where my punk rock band played. And
what was it called?
The concert?
Yeah, the band.
The band? That band was, The Movement.
Okay.
Simple enough, right?
Yeah, yeah.
I was in a pop punk band called Goodbye Me, and then I was in a band called The Movement.
Goodbye Me.
Goodbye Me. I haven't even said that or thought about that in over a decade.
That's good. Like that.
So we threw a show at the school, and kids came. They paid a cover at the door. We raised over $2,000-$3,000, but you know, for a bunch of high school kids, you know, you got an envelope full of cash.
Yeah.
And then we drained the student union budgets for all the front groups, and we threw that money in this envelope. And then we did a aid drive for generic pharmaceuticals and children's clothing and art supplies.
Man, you were really active.
We were really, yeah, we did all this. I still have the press clippings.
What the fuck was I doing in high school?
Jesus Christ. And it's wild to think about now.
Yeah.
We had over a dozen boxes of aid. We had an envelope of over $5,000 in cash, and we were going to send it to Iraq. But the UN and US sanctions have been in place against Iraq since the first Persian Gulf War, right? Since 91. So it was illegal to send anything, especially monetarily or aid, to Iraq. So we ended up getting in contact with a group called Voices in the Wilderness.
Okay.
That, if I'm remembering correctly, the director was named Kathy Kelly, and she won a Nobel Peace Prize and rejected it because Henry Kissinger had won it.
Wow.
She was the real deal.
Principled stand.
So a bunch of 15 and 16 year olds reach out to them and say, hey, we got $5,000 in cash and a dozen boxes of aid. We need someone to get it into Iraq, you know, albeit illegally. So we met them in a parking lot at 7 a.m. on like a Sunday morning.
You met with a Nobel Peace Prize winner?
Yeah, and gave them all the aid and all the money, and they flew it into Jordan and crossed the Iraqi border, you know, on the ground. And they got all of this aid to Iraq.
Wow.
Subsequently, we had a visit from the intelligence services post 9/11.
No shit.
I was 16, yeah.
What? Sounds like a book. It's going to be called Goodbye Me.
So fast forward that, I got increasingly more radical. So a lot of anarchist philosophy, Boston is very active in terms of anarchism.
The only other person I've ever talked to on this show about anarchism is Dennis Cooper. He's deep into
that. Hey, there we go.
Yeah.
Good.
So are you still there? Are you still, like, is there still strains of anarchism in your worldview, or is it something that you kind of felt like was in your youth and you sort of moved away from it?
I mean, some of it's a reductionistic temper tantrum for sure. But philosophically, yeah, it was.
Break it down for me again. I can break it down for listeners. Like, just, I mean, broad overview stuff. You don't have to get into the weeds, but what is it? Cause I think people think anarchism and they're thinking like, people like lighting shit on fire and flipping over cop cars and like just going like batshit.
Yeah, well, it's actually sort of back in the news again with you know, Antifa and the anarchists and the Black Bloc and everything. You know, it's back in the news again. So I was doing that a decade ago. I did Antifa work in Boston a decade ago.
You're like, dude, I was old school.
We were doing it, and people didn't even know we existed, or that the neo-Nazi threat or the white supremacist threat was as bad as it was.
Right.
And now look.
Yeah. Well, yeah, now things are, I mean, it's come to the fore, you know?
Yeah, it's come full circle. Well, and now we have the chief, asshole in the White House. So
right.
They all feel emboldened that they're insane.
You've seen this hand signal. Do you know this shit?
This?
The white power hand signal?
Well, that's the Pepe eye.
Is that what it is?
That's what it is, yeah.
This is like W and this is P. I've seen it, I didn't realize this. I'm not 100% in the loop, I guess, but yeah. I was like reading about it on Twitter, and Trump does this hand signal when he talks. And someone was saying he didn't used to do this. Like, this is kind of a new development when he's been doing his stump speech, and then you see all these pictures of these Pepe people or whatever.
Cool. I think if it is any amount intentional, that probably came from the Steve Bannon wing.
Yeah.
You know?
And, I could see Steve Bannon pulling Trump aside and being like, hey, just do this. It'll help you win. And yeah. Trump would be like, okay.
Absolutely.
You know, just make this hand signal when you talk.
So the philosophical strains of anarchism are that the threat to the individual is state power and also global capitalism.
Right.
So that they're both regimes of power. And the anarchist view is that they can't be reformed, that they're totalitarian in nature. It departs widely from, liberal center left politics,
right.
Liberal politics, progressive politics. They're not interested in reform. They see their politics as a form of self-defense, of radical self-defense and community building. And essentially revolutionary self-defense against the state.
Okay. I was talking about this today with somebody at work about capitalism and democratic socialism, like the Bernie Sanders wing of the left right now. And, it's like, I don't know. It's got some hostility towards the worst infractions of capitalism. But politically in your youth, or maybe even today, do you think that there is any way that you could marry democratic socialist policies, humane universal access to healthcare, for example,
right. Yeah.
Greater access to college education? Can you marry those kinds of safety net and progressive social policies with a free market?
It's a great conversation, and I think it's the one that, we've been shoved into having.
But good, right?
A good conversation. I'm glad. Yeah. I mean, the realist in me is I'm in the Bernie Sanders camp. I'm in the progressive camp. Philosophically, though, do I think, is it a losing battle? Does it not get to the root of the issue?
Yeah.
I think there's something to be said for that. I'm not so sure that policy-based progressive reforms are enough to hold back the tide of totalitarian power, both in the authority of the state over the individual and the free reign that global capitalism and corporate capitalism have over us. I don't think the answer is is policy reform.
Or like incremental policy.
Incremental policy reform. Yeah. I don't think the modern nation state was built, or I don't think the modern checks and balances of democracy in America were built to handle the modern global multinational corporation. They've outfoxed, outsmarted, outmaneuvered.
Outspent.
Deregulation became a way for them to, if any policy reform, progressive reform, was ever put in place, deregulation was a battering ram that removed a dozen from the other side.
Yeah.
Right? So it's just, you're bailing water out and then, and you know, a tidal wave hits you on the other, on the back end. So, I think it's a long, painful conversation, but it is not so recidivistic. I mean, social media and the polarity of political dialogue now, is so reactionary and so one-dimensional.
Yeah.
Whether you're right or wrong, it's not even anything resembling discourse. Even people I agree with.
Well,
you know, we're gonna have to get into the messy business of what can work, what will work, and what the true nature of the problem is.
I was gonna say, like, especially when I'm thinking about the fractures on the left. And the, you know, like the Bernie wing versus the Hillary wing and all this stuff, which, by the way, is exactly what Russia wants. They want that.
Absolutely.
Spat. They want to split.
Yep.
You know, so it's like you're sort of playing right into the hands of the people who are fucking with you on social media if you fall for that. But, you know, push that to the side. And there's a conversation that really needs to happen, which I think probably is happening in a lot of places. And, you know, if the, like they just rolled out this single payer bill, however ceremonially, and there were 15 co-signees, which is a development, you know, cause like a few years ago he rolled it out and there was zero.
Absolutely.
So like, you know, he's definitely brought this kind of progressive policy, concern into the mainstream of the party. But the point that I want to make, which is the larger point, and there are weird crossovers between, I think, Bernie and his campaign and Trump's campaign, in that to whoever, you know, to their supporters, and I guess there was some crossover between Bernie supporters and Trump supporters, though I think that's maybe overblown in terms of the number of them. But they were speaking to the same anger and to the same pain in whatever, in different ways, coming at it from different vectors. But I think one of the failings of the modern center left is that they have not realized the depth and breadth of the suffering of working people and poor people in this country who are counting on them to represent them. And I feel like until they get that and like really get it.
And they still have no idea. I mean, it's almost a form of psychosis
or just the insulation. They can't wrap their head around it.
And you want to talk about, you know, real politics for a second, you know, going back to, you know, the end of Carter and the reign of Reagan and the beginning of deregulation, the Democratic Party got its ass handed to it for so long during the Reagan years that the old guard went out, the new guard came in, and they devised a political strategy where they said, how are we going to beat the supermajority on the right?
You're talking about like the new Democrats?
Yeah. So what did they do? I mean, it was married with the development of neoliberal capitalism, right? So when Clinton takes office, policies that were last associated with the Democratic Party, unions, minimum wage, environmental protection, these all went out the window. They were never talking points from the 90s on, ever. They threw the working class under the bus. This whole media fabrication of the white working class, and this is all just division among working people and among the global population, really. You know, the state, going back to Deleuze, one of my favorite Deleuze quotes is, we don't need to get rid of the state. We only need to get rid of the state in us. And that's so powerful. And like what that means, I always return to it as a sort of crucible. What it means to me is we have got to stop talking to each other and talking about ourselves in terms that the state talks about us in. Because the all the state is classification and division, status, legal status, economic status. You know, states don't grant rights. And this is a conversation that the far left and the far right, the polarities that are so big right now, they agree on so much. Why? Because of that deep-seated suffering of the working class in this country.
Right.
The Democrats threw the working class under the bus. They threw the black community and the Latino community and the illegal and immigrant community under the bus a long time ago. They pay them lip service in the past decade. But I'm talking about Clinton coming in, free trade, the global agreement on tariffs and trade was turned into the WTO. I mean, that's what the big, you know, Seattle had the big riot. You know, that's what the big anti-capitalist and anti-globalization
was. That 99?
That was 99, yeah.
Yeah.
And that was right when I was going to school. So I was a big part of that movement in Montreal and Canada and Boston and D.C. World Bank, IMF, global free trade. That's the root. That's the
welfare
structure.
Bill, crime bill, like a lot of these things.
Massive incarceration. This is what Hillary got killed on.
Yeah.
And they think it's a political attack orchestrated by the right. It's not. It's the lack of faith from your own constituency.
Yeah.
You have the audacity to go in black communities that you devastated by mass incarceration and have the audacity to ask them to vote for you.
Well, I mean, this
or
is
that you have their interest at heart.
This is where I take issue.
People see through the bullshit.
Well, right. There's a lack of authenticity. I mean, I hear a lot of, especially on Twitter, you know, a lot of, Hillary supporters who feel that she got a raw deal, which I think she did, who feel that she in so many cases was held to a higher and different standard.
That is most certainly true.
Yeah. So these things,
the gender politics, and because she's a woman, she was held to a higher standard.
Right.
But both things can be true.
That's exactly what I was just going to say. But like, I feel like so many people have a blind spot there because you talk about like, you know, why, well, I forget what percent of it. It's like 47% of white women voted for Trump. Is that right? Or maybe it was
even more,
or maybe it was like voted for Hillary, but like, you know, a surprising number
or more middle to upper class white women voted for Trump than Hillary.
Yeah. So it's like, the
53 to 47 or something.
Yeah. So the point is that like the numbers, you know, you sort of step back. It's like, really, it's not some big gender thing. Like there's a lot of women who didn't vote for her either. And the question I want to know, or I want to ask is why? You know, what's the problem? You know, what's the issue there? Given a choice between like a blatant misogynist like Donald Trump and just like an overall creep and Hillary, like what gives, you know?
Well, I would hope that it comes back to the saving grace of the foundation of this country, which would be people don't vote. I mean, again, reductionistic, you know, this is just striations of the working class. This is infinite division.
Yeah.
And power, the consolidation of power benefits from division and dividing working class people. People don't, you know, white people don't vote for white presidents. Women don't vote for women. Black people don't vote for black presidents.
Right.
It's not one to one.
Right.
People vote for ideals. Right. So you have to ask people why specifically they didn't trust Hillary. I mean, if you took Hillary's legacy, political legacy, in you know, bullet point form and didn't attribute it to her name, her last name, her husband and the former president of the United States, or her gender, her platform is center right. She's a neoliberal capitalist war hawk. So who in their right mind is going to, if you put that resume in front of someone,
you don't think she's center left. You think she's center
right. I think she's center right.
Because of her foreign policy stuff.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, her legacy, you know, in her legacy domestically with drug laws and incarceration alone, dealing with, you know, the massive crackdown of the security state, voted for two illegal wars, sold uranium rights to Russia, the very, you know, boogeyman that, you know, she claims destabilized the election, which is most probably true.
Sure.
I mean, the list just goes on.
Well, that's the thing. I think like the Clintons,
I think she's center right. I don't think she's center left. I think Bernie Sanders is slightly left.
Oh, really?
But that's because I'm, you know,
you're to the left of Sanders.
I'm so far to the left of center. So, like I said, I have one big stripe that's revolutionary anarchism.
Yeah.
I don't believe in the modern democratic state. I don't believe in neoliberal global capitalism. I think, but the realist in me, you know, as an adult with a family, and I'm an introvert and I'm insanely antisocial. You know, okay. I basically just want to live in the woods and write books.
Yeah.
And commune with nature and God and the universe.
I'm sorry I brought you here. I feel bad that you have to talk to me.
I think $15 minimum wage and Bernie's new, you know, universal Medicare and universal healthcare bill, state paid, 4-year undergraduate tuition for state colleges. Do I think that's going to vastly improve the quality of life in this country? Absolutely.
If it can even look at the
amount of political will just to achieve those single issue policy reforms.
Right.
Right. But as a matter of philosophy, you know, we're marching toward the cliff and we need to figure out
what do you want to see happen? What would be your ideal scenario?
I mean, that's like a whole other podcast, right?
I mean, let's go there. Yeah.
I feel like I've been, I don't want to be pedantic. What's yours?
I mean, I guess I definitely would like to see Trump removed from office. I think it's well past time where that, is appropriate.
I thought the process would be started by now.
Yeah.
But I do think Mueller is building, an absolutely bulletproof case.
I hope so. I mean, I think that's the starting point. But I do think that, especially with issues like related to climate and poverty and healthcare, there are so many things that ail the world. You know, there's a million fires to put out, right? I mean, there's so much human suffering all over the place, and so it can be overwhelming to consider it in totality. And I'm not well read enough or smart enough to have a full grasp of all of it. But what I tell myself, and I guess sometimes you ever play this, you know, you play this game where you're like, well, what would I do if I were running for office? Because these people have it's a tough job.
Or even asking, like what you just asked me, what do you want?
What do you want? Yeah.
What's the end goal?
This is what I think. I think like the first thing I would do is I would say, let's try to prioritize catastrophes. What is the biggest emergency?
That would be a start.
Yeah. What's the biggest emergency affecting the most people? Can we answer that question? I would guess it would be climate. And climate is a huge issue that encompasses all sorts of other issues.
We're dealing with a current, you know, insane regime that doesn't even admit that it exists.
Yeah.
I flew down here from Seattle to LAX, and I counted, I saw not one, not two, 8, 9, 10 wildfires.
Yeah, the whole West is on fire.
So the West is on fire. There's 3 Category 4 or 5 hurricanes.
Yeah.
You know, multiple American cities. The disaster relief required, the amount of dollars is tenfold what the infrastructure spending would be.
Right.
Right? But the far right, you know, GOP they act like they don't want to tax anybody. They don't want to tax corporations. The southern states are all the ones that get hit. And then they watching them perform mental gymnastics enough to justify asking for federal aid when they vote against it, they stake their careers on it.
Right.
Is like, you know, they all have to go.
Yeah. It's a big mess.
But in the service, like you said, let's prioritize our biggest problems first.
And then start there.
Climate.
Climate.
And then disasters, right?
Yeah.
So with, you know, moving there, just to respond to that, you could also say, though, that that I think criminal justice reform in the prison system is a slow-moving, consistent, natural disaster.
Yep.
Enacted upon the poor people of this country.
Yeah. And it like a cyclical, and you know, like they can't escape it.
Can't escape it.
And for profit. But I, you know, just to kind of finish the thought, if you ask me what I want to see happen, it would be someone with a really bold agenda and the political capital and support to actually make it happen. Like, I feel like I want these catastrophes to be prioritized, but then we need big action. Like, incremental with climate is not going to cut it. Like, we have a fucking 5-alarm fire happening, and we're like twiddling our thumbs or denying it, you know, all this.
And that's really where you see, and this goes back to the anarchist politics. They always say fascism is what capitalism does when the contradictions get too shaky and it's in a period of crisis and it needs to consolidate itself. Capitalism benefits from the consolidation of power. Fascism is capital's most pure form. Mussolini said fascism should rightly be called corporatism because it's a direct marriage of corporations and the state. So what do we have? What do we have now? We're dangerously close to it. And then you actually see the massive irony is that you see headlines like China, who benefits from a capitalist economy with a communist authoritarian government. And China can just say, you know, we're just thinking about probably outlawing all gas and oil burning cars 5 years from now. Because we can just do that. In the United States, it could never happen.
Right.
Right. So, like, at what point is there a venue to act big,
right,
in democracy,
right,
or in the United States?
What's a good country? Is there a country in this?
Show me a good country.
Yeah, exactly. Where's a country that's working? Is it Sweden? Do we just
Scandinavia is, you know, operating at a surplus, but I mean, they're also incredibly homogenized.
I was going to say
isolated and
yeah,
xenophobic.
So it's either
and beautiful.
I was going to say it's either hot, homogenized, isolated, and xenophobic. That's a good title for a book. But it's like that. It's either like a communist authoritarian regime or a hot, homogenized, xenophobic, and what was the other one? Paranoid, whatever it was. freezing their asses off. It's a huge. These are big questions, and I'm just glad to talk to somebody who's like engaged at the level that you are and have been since you were an adolescent, you know, and like way beyond what I was up to when I was that age.
I mean, in a certain way, I feel like I went in one end of the left and came out the other. And so that gives me a perspective now where I don't know if I know more or less. I have no idea. I mean, I'm incredibly pessimistic, but I mean, it also combines with everything else. It combines with philosophy. It combines with, mythology and the history of literature and art and aesthetics. I mean, it's not one thing to me anymore.
Where are you spiritually?
Spiritually, I am
a void.
A void. I believe there's, you know, an innate intelligent structure to the universe. I think the universe, matter and nature itself is conscious. I think we potentially are living in a simulation, but that we are the creation of the simulation.
Okay.
Or at least a part. We're a part of the source.
Like some sort of digital.
That's interesting. I mean, we can talk about so many aspects of this stuff, right? But all right. So on the surface, I do agree with the new, you know, information coming out of quantum physics, and that the universe may be simulated, or that the universe isn't made out of structural matter. It's not made out of atoms. It's made out of information. Yes, that's true. But the quickest way to summarize it that I thought was so brilliant, I forget where I read it fairly recently, actually, and it's been sticking in my head. Someone said that whatever the governing paradigm of an epoch of history is, that's what the new cutting edge is. That's what the new language is.
Okay.
So like when the scientific revolution happened, it was atomic. Right. And now that we're in the information age of digital media and computers, it's digital information. So the next revolution, the next phase is that the universe and matter itself is consciousness, not the other way around. So hopefully if we are all in the process of becoming conscientious and self-aware, from ourself through to our society and how we live on the planet and how we interact with our planet. Our political systems are just how we manage, right? Like the drama of how we live every day. I hope that the next revolution is consciousness. I think matter and reality itself is consciousness.
I'm kind of there with you, right? It's like, it's like the best analogy I've heard is like, you know, like, we're all waves, you know, like each human being is a wave. We have our lifetime. We like crest, we break, we crash on the shore, we're dead, but we're always the ocean.
Absolutely.
So there you go. Like that kind of makes sense to me.
We emerge from and return to eternity.
Yeah. And we feel, but we forget that we're the ocean. We think we're these waves. We get all caught up in our waveness, but we don't realize our oceanness.
Like Alan Watts said, he was talking about existentialism and existential dread, right? And the fear of not being.
Yeah.
Which, you know, when you're a young artist or you're reading philosophy or whatever, that existentialism is sort of a jumping off point for a lot of people. and Alan Watts said, if existentialism is the fear of going to sleep and never waking up, consider for a moment that you're only here because you woke up having never gone to sleep.
Right, which is true. I mean, you know, like that's a thing too, is I think about death and I'm like, it's probably just going to be like you go to sleep, but you don't wake up.
Right. And potentially that is our natural state.
Yeah. That's what we came from. It's like this weird.
Exactly.
Then like I get into the Buddhism and there's like what, 28 levels of rebirth and you know, whatever it is. And maybe if you're tuned in at some like really deep level of consciousness, you can be somehow, you can maintain some sort of awareness of that process. But for most people, I think it's just night, right?
I believe so.
Just go to sleep.
Yeah. The some of the more philosophical, traditions of Buddhism, when you get into those higher levels of, you know, how they deal with, you know, what happens when you do reach like eliminating karmic debt and when you do retain consciousness after death, you know, those higher levels of the end of enlightenment in Buddhism. I mean, it starts to get really, I don't think these are thoughts that people have. And I would hope that they do.
What do you mean?
That, you know, potentially that reincarnation is that the embodiment in this physical plane is not necessarily a form of punishment, but that it's a lower vibrational state where you actually are trapped in the material world.
Yeah.
And if you can retain your consciousness through death, you graduate into pure enlightenment where you don't have the burden or the drama of being physically incarnated again.
That's what I'm going for.
Yeah. Like when
I
you
just want to vibrate,
basically when you see the light at the end of the tunnel,
go to it.
Well, they're saying resist. You don't have to go to it.
Oh, really?
The light is the soul trap of reincarnation.
Oh,
so that the great, you know, floating void, is all mind. It's all consciousness.
So right? Stay away from the light.
I think so.
Okay.
But you can't,
you heard it here first, people.
Stay away from, avoid
don't
the
go
light.
To the fucking light.
It's like, but I don't think it's up to you. You know, I'm not any expert on Buddhism at all, you know?
Okay.
I don't think it's up to you. I think it's what state your soul and your spirit and your mind are in.
Got to do some work.
We have a lot of work to do.
I do. I feel like I want to do this work, but then like, you know, it's just so much, and to try to do the work, like real spiritual work, and to like, it feels like the world that I live in, I mean, living in the middle of Los Angeles, having a family makes it harder.
Absolutely.
Like to really do deep spiritual work. Like there's a reason why contemplatives are contemplatives.
There's a reason monastic.
Yeah, it makes it a lot easier.
Absolutely.
Makes it a lot easier. So it's like, I wonder.
You live in a monastery on a cliff and you don't have to, you know, have a mortgage or.
That's a great life.
Yeah, absolutely.
If you can.
I'm drawn to it.
I am too.
I
am too.
I take cold showers and take mushrooms in the woods and.
Oh, damn.
I'm pretty much there. I'm there.
I'm going to come up and visit you.
Yeah, you gotta.
We're going to go on a vision quest.
So we'll do that, and then to cool down, we'll listen to vinyl with Johnny Evison and play ping pong.
I mean, you know, it's it's an attract. I think there's a lot of similarities in between the contemplative life and the writer's life. I mean, right? I mean, writing is a contemplative exercise. It's deep work, and you need to have that space and that quiet in order to do it. And I feel like, you know, when everyone's out there, especially I think people who are deep thinkers, people who are drawn to books or whatever, trying to think about how to live. Where do I live? What do I do?
It's Montaigne's last essay.
Yeah. What's the best way to spend my life?
How to live.
I don't want to waste this time I have with whatever the fuck this is. I want to make the most of it.
And fiction is absolutely one avenue circling that question.
Yeah. And I find myself increasingly admiring people and like being in awe of people, especially who at a young age, like in their adolescence or their early 20s, decide to become a contemplative and to renounce and become a monastic. Now, people have different motivations. There are different, some people are better monks than others or better nuns than others. Just like people, some people are, you know, you're in it for the right reasons or you.
And so many other people who are extroverted, they achieve that spiritual activation through community and through help than through helping.
Yeah.
Right. So there's that too.
Yeah. There's different ways.
We need all the help we can get. Right. I'm personally, you know, a solitary, you know, cerebral monastic, you know.
But can you do
writer?
I mean, I guess my question is like, well, it seems really hard to go deep if you're living in the crazy digital crowded world.
Oh, but, I think so.
I mean, man.
I mean, this brings the conversation back to capitalism for me. I mean, everything is just. And now the dominant commodity form of capital is not only digital media, but it's actually the branding of the subjective identity itself. I mean, how do you escape that? You know, I do it. I'm selling books and I'm, you know, you have friends and networks and contacts and you're traveling and
You
gotta have a platform. You gotta have a personal brand these days. But I mean, yeah, I even think it's worse than that. You know, not to pontificate on it, but it again goes back to Deleuze. So when you ask me like what's Deleuze 101, he's really hard to summarize. But one of the things is he wrote two very influential books. One, Anti-Oedipus, that dealt with the ego and the repression of sexual drives and all that. And the second one is called A Thousand Plateaus, and together they were called Capitalism and Schizophrenia. So, you know, on the surface, it makes you laugh, but it's very hard to summarize the argument. But essentially, what I've taken away from it is Deleuze basically is making the argument that capitalism promotes schizophrenia. Another way to say that spiritually is that it promotes mental disintegration because it promotes an abstraction. Capital value on an object is an abstraction. Right? That's back to Marx. But capitalism promotes an unrealizable, a false and abstract and exaggerated and unhealthy relationship with the objective natural world.
Everything's a commodity,
but it also does not possess the qualities that it actually has innately. And so it's capitalism itself, not even excesses of capitalism, not even gross displays of greed.
Right.
Capitalism in its inner workings promotes a false relationship with nature. And these are the roots of the problems that we're going to have to go into.
Right.
If we're going to survive.
So what, like a barter economy or... What are we going
no
for?
Idea.
It's like Burning Man.
Not an economist.
The whole
I don't
world
know.
Is a Burning
Again,
Man.
Again, like, yeah, philosophically, I can think of, I've thought about these things for days, weeks, and years, you know. I love it philosophically. I mean, it's healthy for the mind.
Yeah.
What the answer is, and pragmatically for politics or economics, I don't know. But do you want me to bring it back? You asked me what what I want to see happen.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. You know, let's bring it back full circle.
The ultimate question.
Yeah.
Since you talked about, you had a very great, pragmatic answer that I'm 100% on board with. Let's start with the biggest catastrophes first. I mean, pragmatically, that's I'm on board with that 100%. So, you know, the only thing I have to offer on the other end would be for myself, I want to see a revolution in signification. That stems from, if we just talk, you know, I look at it like critical reason is stripping away falsity. So I just talked about how capitalism promotes a false relationship with objects in the natural world. We talked about the state, even the modern democratic state. States don't grant rights. People have unalienable, innate rights. States choose which rights they can afford to acknowledge and which they can't, or which they don't want to, because it threatens their power structure. So that's the state and that's the economy. But below all of that, on a very deep level, on a civilizational level, on an epochal level, I think we need a new system of signification. I think capitalism has created the masses itself, the idea of the mass of people. I mean, it's wild out there. You know, we're in the middle of Los Angeles right now.
Yeah.
I mean, every day is a rat race. It's just complete insanity.
It's crazy.
It's a scramble for resources.
I've lived here for 2 decades.
And there's less and less resources on this planet. And the poorest places where capitalism just raped the third world first, then the second world, and now it's coming for the first world. There's very soon, potentially in our lifetime or our children's lifetime, there's not going to be much left.
We're a virus with shoes, as Bill Hicks used to say.
Yeah, absolutely. So, and this does go back to my critique of liberal progressive politics and policy reform. Of course, I support it 100%, and of course, I'm on board. But do I think it's a losing effort? Probably, but because this is the root of my philosophical problem, this is what I want to see happen. I think people have been rendered worthless under capitalism because you see the increasing amounts of homeless, you see the increasing amounts of physical and mental illness, that there is no inherent value that they can provide the labor market anymore. So they become, quote unquote, wards of the state. But then the state was deregulated and gutted. So they're wards of nobody and nothing and nowhere anymore. If you don't have any capital with which the system can use you, you literally do not exist. And that is a massive problem. I mean, it breaks my heart. I think the root of any new political or philosophical system would have to be that everybody on the planet, regardless of nationality, legal status, race, gender, class, any fucking abstraction that the state or power would love to create, and the body of the human race on the planet. Capital gets to be global, but people don't. Capital gets to cross borders, but people don't. Right? This is the contradiction that's creating so much friction now. I would love to see new signification, you know, what's been called human rights, something new that acknowledges the inviolable value of every single person on the planet, that doesn't revolve around legal status, that doesn't revolve around citizenship, that doesn't revolve around monetary value or capital or wealth, right?
Yeah.
We're going to need it, or else, you know, there's a Holocaust waiting for us. And our natural environment is going to start flat out rejecting us.
I feel like the Earth, it's very easy to start drawing these comparisons between what's happening with these catastrophic weather events and the fires and everything we just talked about, and, you know, a body producing antibodies to fight off an infection.
Absolutely.
Like, we are the infection, and it's pretty clear that Earth is now, like, the natural systems of the Earth are just basically activating.
We're taking and we're not contributing.
Yeah.
So how are we going to? I mean, this is just a fraction of the great tragedy of the pain at the center of the American continent. You know, this country, you know, it's an old saying. It's been quoted so much, but a country that was founded on genocide and slavery may not ever know peace.
Right.
right? These are the bleeding wounds that are still open.
Big karmic debt.
Huge karmic debt. So, I mean, think about the not just the lives, not just the culture, not just the society. Think about the knowledge and the wisdom that was lost with eliminating the native population of this continent.
Right.
Who better knows how to live on this land? Who better knows how to organize themselves horizontally and not in vertical systems of power? Who better knows how to confederate themselves in horizontal organization where everything is used the most efficient way
possible? I was going to say the ecology.
With damaging the ecology and the earth and the land itself and each other. Humans need to return to ecology. This is like when you read philosophy, you just see the Enlightenment and humanism. You know, yeah, it brought Europe out of the Dark Ages, but humanism separated human progress from nature,
mm-hmm.
created a subject and separated the subject from the object. I think we're going through a very painful process of returning. We have to return.
Got
to
go back to the woods.
To the natural state. Yeah, not even... We have to bring the woods, like Deleuze, right? We have to bring the woods back into us. We don't need to get rid of the state. We need to get rid of the state in us.
Yeah.
And what needs to take its place? The ecology.
The mushrooms.
The mushroom, the fungus, the knowledge of the fungus.
So wait, how often do you do that? Is this something you do like biannually? Like, do you do it like on a, like, I mean, because I can see it as like a medicinal... Once or twice a year, clear the cobwebs, have an experience. Is that kind of what it is for you? And it's a kind of spiritual thing.
Oh, yeah, it's absolutely. Entheogenic plants and psychedelic, activation of your consciousness, it isn't recreational for me. I mean, I think it can be recreational when you're young or... You know, you're irresponsible and you don't really pay for it or suffer for it. But once you know how to treat, it's a system of knowledge. And this is the thing. Everybody can see it now because it's gotten so bad, right? The West is burning. The hurricanes are drowning cities. The fight for resources. LA is in a drought every year.
Have a good trip, everybody.
People can see those warning signs now, but when you take mushrooms or when you take fungus or when you take DMT, user warning, I do not recommend anyone takes DMT. That is not, it is not for the faint of heart.
Okay.
It's the most powerful hallucinogen.
It's like 15 minutes.
It's an entire, yeah. It turns mechanic all day, 1,000 hits of acid in 15 minutes.
Wow.
You've
done it. Have you seen like the self dribbling basketballs and gone into the dome and all that shit?
Yep, absolutely.
You've seen them.
Yep, seen the machine elves.
The machine elves. That's right.
I went through the center of the chrysanthemum and down the silver cord.
So there are consistencies in experience.
Yeah, I saw pyramids with fire shooting out of the top and large alien arachnids walking around in some prehistoric plane.
Wow.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Have you done
it? It's all real. It's all there for anybody who wants to go find it.
I had somebody, who was I talking to? Or maybe I read this. Was I talking to Tao Lin? But it was about a guy who did it. And like, he saw some freaky alligator. It fucking bit him and he freaked out. I mean, it was like an awful.
Having done it, that sounds awful.
Yeah.
I mean, I've had really, DMT is different. DMT, there's no control. DMT is... Like we mentioned the Matrix, right? If you think of a lattice of space time, like the grid, right? Like the grid that if the information is or the universe is information and it is a simulation,
right?
And it's being simulated on a grid.
Okay.
DMT shows you the grid. That's underneath prevailing creation of space time. So if you're not ready to see it, you won't see it. I had transformative trips on DMT that took me a long time to process. It may have fundamentally changed paradigmatically how I even thought about problems or how I even thought thoughts themselves. I had another friend who did it around the same time. He's a musician he asked me what I saw and I told him, some of the stuff I just said. I go, "So did you see any of that?" And he was looking at me like with his jaw open and he goes, "I didn't see any of that." I was like, "What did you see?" And he goes, "Well, I saw the elves." He goes, "But I only saw one elf." And I was outside of my house in New Hampshire, and the elf was sitting on a branch in a tree. And he was pointing at me and laughing. And there was little objects coming out of his mouth when he was laughing.
What do these elves look like? They look like basketballs?
They look like the fucking Expedia elf or the Priceline elf or whatever the hell. They look like...
elves?
Yeah. I think the basketballs are sort of the vehicles they use to travel.
Oh, okay.
But that's how they arrive. And then they're just there.
Holy shit.
I mean, it sounds completely bananas to anybody that hasn't done it. Anyway, he said, he's a very sort of pure heart and very innocent guy.
Yeah.
And, he said the elf was laughing at me and said that I looked like a greasy monkey and that I had no business being there. And he was stopping me at the gates and he just told me to turn around and go home.
Just you're not ready for this.
You're not ready for it. How did you even get here?
God, now I feel self-conscious. I wonder if would the elves accept me?
But, you know, back to the moral, you know, the big question was fungus and mushrooms and psilocybin. Those are systems of knowledge. It's like it's plant RNA. Those are that is our DNA. Plant RNA is the story of information and knowledge and experience on this earth that is potentially hundreds of thousands or millions of years old. This is a plant planet. They've been here a lot longer than we have. And when you take them and you start, like you said, the wildfires and the hurricanes, people are starting to listen. So if you take mushrooms and you meditate and you start to think about the state of your soul, your own soul, the state of your spirit, whether you're wounded, how you're wounded and how you can be healed, and then what type of thoughts you have, and what type of energy you vibrate on, and how you connect with everything, returning back to the ecology, that system of information is trying to speak to you. And all you have to do is decondition yourself enough to listen.
Yeah. That makes a lot of sense. I mean, I feel like I've always felt like there is something there, and I've talked about it on this show a million times. And that maybe articulates like the importance of it better than maybe anybody I've ever spoken with about it, is that you've got to get back into touch with plant ecology. Like we all come from the earth. Like that's not like, you know, woo woo bullshit. That's the truth.
It's not. And it's going to be our savior. To be our future.
And so it's also going to be where we're going back to.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, the rich are very busy building rockets and one-way missions to Mars to terraform the moon and Mars to get the fuck off this planet. And guess what? The ones that can afford it are going to leave, and we're all going to be stuck here with the mess they made. You know,
but they're going to be on fucking Mars, dude.
Exactly.
Mars. Go to Mars. I don't want Mars.
Yeah, there's like, 8,000 nukes on this planet? Like, they're going to leave a couple? Just let them go to Mars, and then we'll take care of them.
I'm very bearish on Mars. I've never understood the obsession. Like, if it were like
fucking arrogance to think that they can turn anything into what they want.
Well, yeah, like Elon Musk is like, we'll just nuke we'll nuke the poles and we'll
there's no atmosphere. You have to terraform an atmosphere. Yeah, we'll nuke the poles to create polarity.
What's it called? Geoengineering? Yeah.
Well, that's what they think they're doing right now. But, you know, no, it's so true. But thank you for saying that. I mean, these are types of conversation that, you know, from literature to philosophy to spirituality, like we're in deep shit. And I think in general, I think so many people, whatever type of pain they're in, whatever their experiences are, I think everybody is starting to sense that we need to return to that we knew once how to survive on this planet. And there's a great amount of knowledge that's been forgotten, and it's still here and it's speaking. And we just have to listen.
Have you done 5 dried grams? You done the Terrence McKenna thing?
That is so funny you asked me that. Yes, I have.
Wow. And were you just like, was it like a white knuckled? Well, I mean, was it? Because I feel like if you're up in the woods in the Pacific Northwest, like that's the place to do it.
So like you're saying, if you feel like you got to return to, you got to get in touch with plant ecology, come see me in the Pacific Northwest. Yeah. That's it's a rainforest.
5 dried grams.
No, 5 dried grams is, again, like I said about DMT, not for the faint of heart.
Yeah, you got
to
be ready.
5 dried grams is not a fun time. You have to be ready. I mean, it is like an old, I mean, as, you know, the different plant medicines, as shamans call it, they're different plant medicines.
Yeah.
You know, iboga is getting people to kick narcotics and sure. heroin, right? Now, finally, after the in lunacy of the drug war, even though those fucking laws are still in place, they're academically they're starting to loosen because the you know the war against the counterculture of the 60s is complete.
Yeah.
So everything's been properly commodified. It's safe for pharmaceutical companies to use MDMA to treat anxiety and depression. You know, because they're tired of paying for lawsuits or people fucking overdose on their on the pharmaceuticals.
Right.
You know, this medicine's been here the entire time. And every single, whatever state you're in, whatever your condition is, you will know. It'll tell you. You know, the, it's like getting a lesson from, so you said 5 dry grams, the Terrence McKenna thing. It's like getting a lesson from a very stern, ancient ancestor.
Yeah.
It's like, if you think like your terse, tough as nails grandfather was bad. This is your great, 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 great grandfather.
It's going to take you to like the psycho-spiritual woodshed.
Oh, yeah. It's brutal. It shows you every, like, all of the waste and imbalance in your psyche.
You're really selling people on this.
It hurts. It hurts on the level of bone. Yeah. Yeah. I'm writing an essay right now about the nature of cold. The last time I did mushrooms is I'm a New Englander and I love the cold.
Uh-huh.
I really want to, one of the things I'm getting into in the essay is I really want to study with Wim Hof.
Yeah.
Have you heard of him?
Yeah.
The ice dude, man.
Yeah. He does like these crazy swims in like freezing water. And
he has a meditative breathing practice mixed with meditation where he does like insane cold water immersion. And he did all the scientific tests and there's been documentaries and any article that's ever been written about him is really annoying because it's from this, the arrogant point of view of a skeptic trying to prove him wrong. And then, of course, like the cold breaks them down and they're like, no, he's legit. I love the cold and sometimes I do mushrooms and I like submerge myself in like the glacial rivers and
you
like
jump into the river.
I do. Yeah.
Dear God.
Yeah, I know. And it's like in the Cascade Mountains and, you know, the Olympic National Park. And I mean, it's gorgeous up in the Pacific Northwest.
Of course. Yeah.
But the water's cold.
Yeah. I was going to say.
The water is fucking freezing.
It's like you already got enough going on sensory wise. Jump into a freezing river.
Like Wim Hof. And one of the things Wim Hof said, the cold is God. And then I started, I want to learn his actual method because I don't know it. But I have amazing pain tolerance. And I have an amazing threshold for the cold. So I just, you know, I take showers all the way on cold. I can swim in cold rivers. I mean, I'm from New Hampshire and I go, like you said, like you surf in New Hampshire. I mean, there's guys that do it in February in a dry suit. I mean, that's insane.
It's supposed to be healthy.
It like is.
Cold plunges.
Like, oh, it's great
there's
for
like
you.
A whole, there's like a whole thing of it's good for your body.
But, all right. So what is climate change? The planet's heating, right? A lot of the excesses are coming from heat, whether it's, you know, animal agriculture, whether it's combustion, right? Whether it's CO2 and greenhouse gas, a lot of our problems are coming from overheating. And the cold is like, for me, I realize it on mushrooms that helped me moving back in the direction of cold.
Okay.
Everything and capitalism, the entire fucking paradigm of the culture of seeking pleasure, right? Buying objects, fetishizing objects, seeking desire. That's what they're always selling you. So move in the opposite direction. Move in something that is distinctly not pleasurable.
Let's go
and
jump,
not desirable.
Go
at all.
Jump in a frozen river.
When's the last time anyone, you know, your average Joe on the street did that? Made a conscious decision to do something that is definitely not going to be pleasant. And what are you going to learn?
What are you going to learn? Tell me.
Like you said, what,
save me the trouble.
They were a human fungus.
So Darkansas. Am I pronouncing that right?
Yeah.
It's not Dark Kansas.
No, it is not. Okay. Arkansas. Like so Arkansas with a D.
You're setting a book in the Ozarks. Guy from Boston and New Hampshire and Seattle. How did you land there?
I had a story about two twin brothers. One of them was a bluegrass musician in the shadow of his father, who was a famous bluegrass musician. The other one was getting married back home. And they had a contentious childhood and, they went back for the wedding and it was actually a failed short story to begin with. It was just
many great novels begin as failed short stories,
right? It was a half a dozen drafts. it wasn't working. And I only had this little sketch for the short story years ago that just sat dead on the vine, about the brothers. You know, the short story was only the brothers meeting at the wedding and getting in like a rough and tumble fight. And you reconstructed their fallout from it. But I was like, there's so much more here. So then I started researching. I started adding different things to that nugget of conflict.
Okay.
Right. And then, so I started building out, and I was like, okay, well, this bluegrass music, like, what is the real tradition of bluegrass music? It's really Appalachia and Kentucky. And then it's the Ozarks. So I was like, all right, well, the Ozarks is one of those mysterious, it's one of those great places to set a novel, because
like Winter's Bone.
Like Winter's Bone, and that's why Daniel Woodrell is the king of the Ozarks.
Yeah,
he is. So, you know, it was, that's where that story happened. It had to happen there. It had to be there.
Did you go research it?
I did.
You did?
I did. Yeah.
Jumped in a river.
Well, that's the thing. The geology of the Ozarks is an anomaly. I get into it in the book a little bit. There's a lot of, you know, karst hydrology. I read like academic works on karst hydrology and how the Ozarks formed, a lot of underground rivers. I love the metaphor of water moving underground, like it was consciousness moving underground, carrying one thing that was unrelated subconsciously from point A to point B.
It's reminding me of the Talking Heads song.
Causal relation. Which one?
What, the water, like water is moving underground. That's lyrically.
Where the water moving. Yeah. Once in a lifetime.
Yeah, there you go.
You might ask yourself.
Yeah. So there was water
These
moving
aren't my children.
This isn't my house.
This isn't my house.
The fuck am I? There's an elf. There's an elf in the garage. So there was water moving underground in the Ozarks. I didn't know. Like, I don't know. It's like history, like geologically. Yep. Or.
And then So the central thrust of the plot in Dark Inside is the black ship. Well, while they're home for Malcolm's wedding, Jordan, the black sheep of the family, discovers a secret in their family history that going back to the end of the Civil War in Arkansas, in the Ozarks on the Missouri border, every generation of men in their family have been twins, like he and his brother. In every generation, one twin always ends up murdering their father.
That's cheery.
So it's a cyclical murder myth that repeats through time. So against the backdrop of the wedding, there's these alternating historical chapters that go back. And then it gets to a forgotten Civil War battle that happens in the Ozarks in 1862. And it, what is now a ghost town, it's still on the map. Based it on a real battle. So I got way into lost Civil War history in that area. You know, homesteading, bluegrass, moonshining, evangelical movement. And it, like, it's all in there.
Wow.
So it just built organically. That was the story. You know, I never understand. I mean, the again, another function of capitalism and markets. I don't understand why there's such a focus on fiction writers writing what they know. Writing where they're from. Yeah, I just don't get it. It's fiction. Like I said one time at a reading when somebody asked me, like, Ray Bradbury never went to Mars.
Right.
You know, like, it's called fiction.
Yeah, but there's different kinds of writers. I think, like...
No, there are. There's some writers that write the same novel, different aspects of the same story their entire lives, which is fascinating. It's just not what I'm doing. You know, like, again, I am going home now. The new novel I'm writing is about a hockey player that gets the head injury, right? And then he has to go home to Massachusetts in the middle of the winter, which is very depressing and cold.
Right.
And he gets prescribed a series of antipsychotics, anti-seizure drugs, and painkillers. And then and there's a huge opiate epidemic in the whole country.
Yeah, but
in New England.
The
Northeast is very bad. You know, me and my family and friends, dozens of people that have OD'd.
Really?
Absolutely. It's terrible. And it's all in small, depressed, post-industrial, working class towns, you know.
It's a big fucking problem.
It's horrible.
Yeah.
So that's what I'm drawing from. And now that, you know, for me, it's the easiest thing I've ever written because I'm drawing on growing up playing hockey, right? But I'm getting into the psychology and you know, the neuropathology of CTE and how they're going to treat it, but also what the symptoms are. And then I use it for my character. I use it to trigger an existential crisis where he doesn't know who he is when he's not playing hockey. Because that was really the, I read a lot of interviews and essays with players, and because of my dad and my history, I'm so lucky I get to talk to a couple players that whose careers were ended by head hits.
Uh-huh.
So they start to, I'm like, I don't want to know the story. I don't want to know about you as the player. I want to know about the personal struggles. I want to know about depression. I want to know about not being able to turn lights on in your house. You know, I want to know about loud noises that happen 5 miles away that are piercing and move to the center of your brain. The loss of identity and subjectivity and self. And then I'm combining that with the opiate problem in New England.
So it's a comedy.
This is a comedy, exactly.
Well, it all sounds fascinating, man. And I've really enjoyed meeting you, getting a chance to talk with you about all this stuff. You're a deep thinker, and I think you have your eye on the ball. You're thinking about a lot of really important stuff, and I think we need people who are willing to go down into the weeds on this. And it's not easy stuff to confront. It's not like, you know, it's not fun to sit around thinking about, what do I want to happen? What are the deepest ills of the world? But we need our writers, especially, I think, to do this work. So I salute you for doing it. Congratulate you on the publication of Dark and Saw. Glad that we can shine a little light on it in the book club. And just thank you for making time to come over.
Thanks for having me, Brad. Like I said, I've been, you know, between being a fiction writer and being an editor and being in the literary community for years, I've listened to the podcast for years. You know, we've interacted, but it's such a pleasure to be first time on the podcast and first time to meet you in LA as well. So deeply grateful, and it was a wonderful conversation.
All right, you guys, there you go. That's Jared Middleton. What did I tell you? Good conversation, huh? His novel is called Darkensaw. It is available now from DeZank Books. It is the official November pick of the Nervous Breakdown Book Club. Go get your copy right now. Darkensaw by Jared Middleton. Thanks to Kill Rockstars for the music. As always, be sure to check out killrockstars.com. Don't forget about the Other People app. That is free. Get it for your device. It's an easy way to listen to the show. Keep track of new episodes. If you would like to support the show, you can do so at patreon.com/otherpplpod. If you would like to support the t-shirt fundraiser for the Salus's family, just go to the Other People Twitter feed at OtherPPL, or go to OtherPPL.com. Track down the link for the t-shirt fundraiser. It's very easy to do. It's a great cause. Please support it. If you would like to join the Nervous Breakdown Book Club, more information is available at thenervousbreakdown.com. Just click on Book Club in the menu bar. What else? I feel like I'm covering everything. There's a lot of details to cover, a lot of logistics, but I think that's it. I really did enjoy talking with Jared Middleton. A lot going on. Hope you guys enjoyed it too. So, very pleased with the outpouring of love and support that I've seen from the literary community for Matthew Salus's. I gotta say, it's been... I was telling him, we were messaging back and forth, and I was saying, you know, I think this is the most positive experience I've had on the internet in recent memory, to say the least, and definitely top five ever. Sometimes, you know, good things can happen on the internet when you see people come together and support a cause, and I'm particularly moved by the fact that so many people supporting this effort are like a bunch of broke-ass writers, let's be honest. You know, if we can come together and get something like this done, then certainly, a lot is possible in this world in terms of helping one another out. So I'm moved by generosity from people who don't necessarily have a ton to give, but are giving anyway. That's a beautiful thing, and that's something worth emulating. And it's also, you know, it brings up questions about like, well, where's the line? How much can I give? You know, we have a tendency, I think, as human beings sometimes when faced with need to kind of retract. Or like be like, well, you know, can I do this? I might need this for me. I might need this for say, but you know what? Who needs it more is a good question, perhaps. And certainly at this point, what Matt and his family are dealing with, they need it more than most everybody I know. So step up, get a t-shirt, do a good thing, support that cause. And thank you from the bottom of my heart to Roxanne Gay and to everyone who has done so to this point. We'll talk to you next week.